Many writings from the 14th and 15th centuries depict a kind of mock trial between Satan and the Virgin Mary over the eternal fate of all human souls, with the two representing contrasting ways of applying the law. It was a time when guilt or innocence was determined with a trial by ordeal in some cases, involving cold water or hot iron, and a strange logic to us at least behind the final judgment. How did the Middle Ages see the relationship between law and justice, and how does that thinking carry into U.S. law today? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Carl Shoemaker, professor of history and law at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
This whole question of law in the Middle Ages and going back farther, I suppose, is something that is likely to sound, in many cases, very foreign to us today, a very different kind of worldview in laying down laws and interpreting them. How would you summarize the difference?
You're right that sometimes when I am introduced to people and they find out I work on medieval legal history, one of the first questions they sometimes ask is, "Oh, did they have law?" And it's true that there are significant differences. You touched on one in your intro, the notion that the guilt or innocence could be determined by whether the body submerged into cold water or whether hands who carried a hot iron would be burned or whether they would heal properly. And this was a mode of trial in the Middle Ages until 1215, actually, when it was abolished. What's interesting about this moment historically and why I think this medieval legal history is important for how we think about law today is that two really important transformations occurred at the time the ordeal was abolished. One is the emergence in England of reliance on the jury as a way of determining guilt or innocence, and that, of course, is enshrined in our Constitution in the U.S., and we still rely on juries for such things. Outside of England, on the continent of Europe, since I'm a specialist in European legal history, it's important to note that legal procedures put in place to replace the ordeal in 1215 for purposes of finding proof also continued on for quite a long time. There was a heavy reliance on torture, for example, to extract knowledge from witnesses and from the accused. And those practices lasted for almost 500 years. And in some ways, I think it's possible to read the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution as well as the French Declaration of the Rights of Man as a repudiation of this longstanding medieval jurisprudence. But of course, it lasted a lot longer than just the Middle Ages.
And as soon as we start talking about trial by ordeal through cold water and the idea that, well, if you're innocent, you'll sink? Is that the way it works?
The water would have been blessed by a priest. So yes, if you were innocent, the water would receive you. The practices vary. It's difficult to talk about the trial by ordeal as if it was a universal practice, familiar everywhere in Europe. But one of the things we know is that people who were subjected to it, men and women who were subjected to it, would have to submerge typically up to the length of their hair. So they would knot the rope, they would bind them up, truss them up, lower them into the water. If they submerged, then that was a sign of their innocence. If they bobbed on top of the water and were rejected, as it were, by the water, that was a sign of their guilt. In neither case were they left to drown. In both cases, they would be removed from the water and then either allowed to go free on their innocence or subject to punishment on their conviction.
So. It does smack a little bit of something as late as the Salem witch trials, though, that kind of thinking.
Yeah, the witch trials, which of course are an early modern phenomenon, medievalists are keen to point out that the witch trial craze was really a later phenomenon. It's not that medieval justice has purely clean hands on these matters, but the turn towards persecuting women accused of witchcraft is really a much later phenomenon. But that's right, there were instances of so-called floating witches and other tests which were meant to determine their guilt or innocence.
It was a hard time to be accused of something. And that year that you mentioned, 1215, of course, a lot of us would think of legally, we're going to think of King John and the Magna Carta. coincidence? Was there something in the air? Was there a tie?
I think it's largely coincidence. You know, John sort of reluctantly signed Magna Carta in June of 1215, and Runnymede, of course, Pope Innocent III very quickly annulled the whole thing, rendering it empty from the standpoint of the Church. But it was the same Pope Innocent III who convened the Fourth Lateran Council later in the fall of 1215, and it's there that he specifically prohibits priests, members of clergy, from participating in divine ordeals. So by removing priests, he never says you can't do the ordeal. He says priests can't participate. But of course, the priests were the linchpin because they had to bless the iron that would be heated. They had to bless the water. They would be the ones to interpret the results, to examine the wounds, to determine guilt or innocence. So in a somewhat unusual, I think the trial by ordeal abolition is somewhat unusual because after Innocent III promulgates this canon sort of prohibiting priestly participation, the ordeal kind of goes away rather quickly. Lots of things in medieval law are prohibited, and then they just continue, and then they're prohibited again, and they continue. But the ordeal does fade fairly quickly. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is it was abolished not just because the Pope didn't like it, but lots, both at the sort of a level of elite, the intelligentsia, if we will, the leading lawyers and theologians of the day, were very suspicious that the ordeal might not actually be a very good way to determine these things. They were suspicious both in terms of scientific proof. Some of them observed that your chances of submerging into the water to a sufficient depth were much greater if you had the good sense to expel all the air from your lungs so that you were less buoyant. They noticed things like heavily calloused hands tend to pass the ordeal better because they don't fester. They can withstand the burns. But there was also theological concerns, and these really drove the question that the ordeal might be an inappropriate tempting of God, that it might be a sort of demand that a miracle be performed in every instance of legal procedure.
Thou shalt not put the Lord thy God to the proof.
That's right. Christ's answer to the devil in the Gospels. So all of and we also know the ordeal was really unpopular at the level of people who were subjected to it. Cities in Europe would often try to get immunities, get charters immunizing them from having to rely on the ordeal. We know also that the ordeal was fairly unpopular among communities in various kingdoms of medieval Europe. So in 1215, when it's gone, it's both, I think, the result of elite opinion, but also the result of common opinion, also sort of being suspicious about the efficacy of the trial by ordeal. But the results, the legal processes that arise from that, the jury trial in England and the inquisitorial modes of trial in Europe, stay with us for a very long time.
One aspect of the Church as we go past forward in time from 1215, which seems to have gone on really for quite a long time. I don't know if it's still with us in some form or not, but this concept of sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. Sanctuary, of course, predates Christianity in the ancient Roman world, in the ancient Greek world, the ancient Egyptian world. There were practices in which temples or other designated places could serve as an area of protection, perhaps temporarily, but protection for fugitives, for runaway slaves, for accused criminals. These practices were so widespread throughout the Roman Empire that as Christianity emerges in the earliest centuries, there is a very clear understanding that Christian leaders, bishops, and priests have a responsibility to provide intercession and to the extent they can, protection for a wide class of criminals, of escaped slaves. And a question arises very early on about whether or not Christian churches should provide the same kinds of protections that the pagan sanctuaries had provided. And the answer by the third and fourth centuries of Christianity are yes. Imagine if the protections of the pagan temples are such, how much more protection should Christian churches? So there's a sense that this practice was an acceptable part of Christianity and an attempt to really elevate it above. So there's a real central duty on the part of churchmen to protect fugitives. We see expressed through legal treatises, through episcopal pronouncements. It's incorporated both into Roman law as it emerges in the late imperial and and medieval period. It's incorporated into the church's own law governing its internal matters, the canon law. It's also present in the English common law. The English common law is in the late medieval period as a very strong predilection for protecting sanctuary and for protecting sanctuary seekers. So
I would guess there could be two parts to that. One would be, which we can get into in greater detail shortly, the space itself. But what about the protection for the clergy in terms of sanctuary?
Yeah, this is an anxiety among the clergy. Sometimes their duty to protect fugitives would put them in a difficult spot between a fugitive and the fugitive's pursuers, for example. We have some instances, for example, some saints in the Middle Ages on their deathbeds are made to say, whether the chronicler is making this up or whether they actually said it is a different thing, but sometimes they'll say things like, bury me at a remote distance from here because my body will become a shrine. There'll be as a relic, will attract not just pilgrims, but it'll also attract fugitives, and you'll be put in difficult positions where you have to defend against their powerful pursuers. So there's this awareness.
His very remains would be a place of sanctuary.
Well, they'd be a relic, yes. And since they'd be buried within the church, the site of the church. But the sanctuary is often extended outside the walls of the church. They would include the porch. And eventually there's a sort of convention around defining a space, a quite large space around the church, including the sanctuary, for example, sometimes adjacent houses. Because sanctuary seekers might be there for a period of time, so there was a need to the necessities of life had to be taken care of, so there was sort of an allowance that they could exit and do certain things and then return to the sanctuary.
How would some of these cases be worked out? I think there must have been some notable ones where somebody who probably was witnessed committing a crime flees into the church. Some legal wrangling could go on for a good long time, couldn't it?
Potentially. The English common law arrives fairly early at a set of procedures aimed at exactly this. And the procedures went like this. You could have sanctuary for any felony, murder, rape, arson, the most serious, the most heinous crimes. You could have sanctuary. But the sanctuary could only last for 40 days. So while you were in sanctuary, you were assured no one was permitted to enter the church and do violence to you as long as you stayed within the church or the precincts. Anyone who did such a thing would be guilty of very serious crimes, both under English law and the law of the church. But at the end of the 40 days, you would have to abjure, the technical term is abjure, that is forswear the realm of England. You would be assigned a port, you'd be put on a ship, and you'd be given passage, typically to France across the Channel, but occasionally to other places in the North Sea as well, to Scotland or Ireland. And we know that thousands upon thousands of fugitives who claimed sanctuary after their 40-day period.
They were just banished?
Were essentially banished. That's right.
I mean, presumably they could never come back to England.
That's right. And surprisingly enough, the record-keeping capacities of the English crown in the 12th and 13th centuries were such that they would keep a record of the names of all of these men and women who abjured, who claimed sanctuary and abjured. And there were occasions where they would consult these records and get witness testimony. Is this the John that abjured the realm 10 years ago? And if it was yes, then John faced some fairly serious legal consequences. You know, the exile came with the requirement to relinquish all of your belongings. According to the statute books that survive, you would have to don a white garment with a red cross on the front, barefoot, no hat, and stay on the main road. So the imagery here is very much of a penitent, or even if someone going to the Holy Land, there's a sort of penitential aspect to it. So even though the crown, sort of secular jurisdiction, has control of this, it has a lot of features that still share the affinities of the religious discipline of the church. But it avoids what would have happened to any felon were they captured, which was a fairly summary execution.
I suppose there was a much broader role for the church in relation to sanctuary, in that we hear often of maybe an illegitimate child who becomes a priest or a nun and just kind of moves into the church and never leaves.
Yeah, there's in the work that I did for the book I wrote on sanctuary and crime in the Middle Ages, it was very clear that among landed elites, there was a different set of protections. One could, in fact, stay in churches much longer. And, of course, if one took holy orders, then the matter was settled. You could stay as long as you like. But the records for this that survive today are incredibly rich, and they show just a range of various human interactions, you know, sort of all the drama that we associate with conflict today existed then, and it's recorded. We can see people taking sanctuary. We can see their pursuers either violating the sanctuary or giving up. So there's some really, really colorful depictions of sanctuary that that were really fun to work with.
This is an earlier example, I realize, but it's certainly a glaring one. And I assume there were other instances less famous to us today of actual murder in a church. I'm thinking of Becket, of course, yeah. But looking forward a couple of centuries from there.
There were a couple of high-profile murders within churches in England, even after Becket in the 13th and 14th century. There's a few. They happen at matters of real high political intrigue as well, and have sort of lasting effects. One of the really interesting things about sanctuary in England as it's phasing out. So by the 16th century, and particularly by 1624 in the early 17th century. The Parliament has issued a series of statutes that basically foreclose the possibility of sanctuary. But in that period just before that, there is a lot of political intrigue at the highest levels within England in which sanctuary plays a prominent part, because those who are getting the worst of it, those families that are losing out in the competition for dynastic power, are often resorting to sanctuary, typically as a last resort. But it does put the church again in a potentially awkward position against royal authority, protecting families or contenders for the throne who were on the outs. So.
Any instances we know of where sanctuary was violated?
Yeah, I mean there are certainly violations of sanctuary. One of my favorites, and I don't know if this will be well known to your listeners, but in the late 12th century, so fairly early for these records, there's a kind of rabble-rouser in London who is wildly successful. He attracts about 30,000 followers to himself. His name is William Longbeard. He very successfully sort of casts himself as a loyalist to the throne who's trying to protect the crown from disloyal nobles. So he gets himself caught in a vice, essentially, between royal authority and local nobles. But it's also partly a sort of early tax revolt and perhaps along the lines of sort of later peasant rebellions. He's able to raise a fairly substantial contingent armed with pikes and other implements they've formed mostly out of farming tools to pose a serious threat in London. Well, he gets the worst of it. He eventually holds up in Westminster Cathedral, where the authorities decide that their only course of action is to burn him out. So they actually do violate sanctuary in the grossest way. But they weren't completely unaware of what the church law would require in such instances. The church law said there are instances where churches and cathedrals become deconsecrated and no longer offer the protection. So it was surmised that the William Longbeard and his mistress holed up in this church had fornicated within the church, therefore
deconsecrated it,
taking it all of its protections away, and therefore they were permitted to do what they did. But one can read these chronicles a bit cynically and suggest that maybe there's more to it. But,
we're going to look further at this concept of what we're actually going to be calling the devil at law in the Middle Ages when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Carl Shoemaker, and we're looking at the role of the devil at law in the Middle Ages and the whole concept of law as it was in the Middle Ages. We've been looking of late at this phenomenon of sanctuary in which the church and its officials can provide sanctuary for some period of time, at least, to a renegade of one kind or another. And it does make me wonder, Carl, what holdover is that concept of sanctuary involved in today? Is it still with us?
It is. It very much is. Most of the legal regimes in Europe by at least the 1700s had largely restricted the reach of sanctuary. So a practice that had been quite robust throughout the thousand-year period before that was largely restricted. The one notable exception is the law within the jurisdiction of the Roman Catholic Church, what we call canon law. That its provisions continued to allow for sanctuary. In 1917, there's a revision of the canon law code, and it allows for sanctuary, but it introduces notions of public necessity. So there are instances where sanctuary wouldn't be appropriate. And that's an interesting restriction, because the church's jurisprudence prior to that hadn't really focused on the reasons for denying sanctuary. It had tended, there had been some restrictions enacted, but it becomes explicit in the code of 1917. There's a revision again in 1983 in which there's no mention of sanctuary at all in canon law. So it's not formally abolished. It just sort of disappears. But of course, as we know, there are prominent instances both in the U.S. and in Europe and other parts of the world in the last year, in the last 5 years, where people typically in situations where they are undocumented for immigration purposes have gone to churches in the U.S. You know, I think as of about a year ago, there were about 500 people in various churches across the U.S. who were not in the U.S. legally, but were awaiting the disposition of either asylum claims or something else, using being actively sheltered by churches who understood themselves to be participating in this quite ancient Christian practice of protecting fugitives.
But this sanctuary of the church, since 1983 anyway, probably for a long time before that, does not extend to actually intervening in a way that would prevent outside authority from coming in.
In the few instances I have had the opportunity to talk to members of the clergy who are actively protecting sanctuary seekers, they've all made the decision that if the federal authorities were to enter, they would not make any effort to prohibit that. In a handful of cases, I've been contacted by clergymen who've read my book and asked questions about it, which is, as medievalists, we don't often get asked about the impact of our research on contemporary issues. And I had the opportunity to participate in a documentary about a woman who was claiming sanctuary in Columbus, Ohio. So these are really compelling stories. And what's really fascinating to me is to see the way in which contemporary church communities begin to understand themselves as continuing practices that date from the earliest years of Christianity.
As long as we mentioned the devil, I've seen it said that the earliest instance, biblically speaking, of the devil being involved in the law actually goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden and Adam blaming Eve, and I suppose by extension, you know, the devil,
yes,
for tempting him with the apple.
That's right.
Is that a kind of a form of litigation?
Medieval jurists, particularly canon lawyers in the Middle Ages, like to say so. So when they see this questioning that occurs after Adam and Eve eat the forbidden fruit, they see this as a form of inquisition, in which the God is acting as the judge. And when Adam says, "The woman that you gave me, she gave me the fruit to eat," this is a kind of what we call today impleading, is sort of bringing in a third party to share or to perhaps wholly carry the blame. The reason that canon lawyers in the Middle Ages like to say this is that they were in a fairly intense competition in the late Middle Ages with theologians as two separate professions within the institutional authority of the church. there are periods of back and forth where the theologians are getting all the choice appointments, and then the lawyers are getting the choice appointments within the administrative hierarchy of the church. So when the canonists say this, what they're really doing is positioning their discipline at the beginning. They're saying we're just as important as you theologians. We belong there because our discipline was also at stake at the very beginning. I think that's what's at play there. But the canonists were very keen, that is the lawyers within the church, to assert that their understanding of law and their ability to rule on various matters of law around sort of, you know, the human condition made them capable of ruling generally within the church hierarchy. And that's actually, I think, where this lawsuit between the devil and Mary comes in.
Well, if you're a litigant in that, who won that case?
Well, I don't want to ruin any of the suspense. But Mary,
spoiler alert.
Mary wins the suit, and she wins it in a really unconventional way. But before I describe how she wins the suit, I think it's important to say that one of the really interesting things about this text, which this imagines this lawsuit between the devil and Mary, is that throughout the argumentation, which is done at a fairly sophisticated level using Roman law sources and canon law sources that the educated elite lawyers of the day would have been familiar with, Mary holds her own. She knows how to use these legal sources to her advantage to make a strong case defending humankind against this kind of class action suit in which the devil's trying to gain possession of them. But she doesn't win the case with a legal argument. She actually wins the case with a very dramatic gesture in which she strides forward, God sitting in judgment. She rips her, she's described as ripping her garments open and exposing her breasts. And she says to God as judge, who's also, of course, according to Trinitarian theology, her son, Christ, yes, as the son. She says, I carried you in this womb for 9 months. I nursed you from these breasts. If you find against me in this judgment, then just delete me from the book of life, right? In other words, consign me to hell. So
isn't that what we call deus ex machina? Well, I mean, she can win every case that way, right?
That and a little maternal guilt thrown in, I think. And in fact, the devil responds at this point. He says, I plead for justice. This is flesh and blood, not justice being done, right? Now, we talked about the ordeal a little bit earlier, and I think to an extent for some of the readers in the 14th century who would have had a knowledge of the legal transformations with the abolition of the ordeal in 1215, Mary's offering her proof by her body very much the way the ordeal required someone to undergo a kind of physical test. So I think for the medieval readers, this awareness that there's something very ordeal-like about what Mary's doing, wouldn't have been lost on them. She's also weeping as she does it. And this is really, really important because there is a lot of medieval legal writing about the efficacy of tears, both as a proof of sincerity, as a proof of holiness.
Jesus wept.
Jesus wept as well. That's right. And in the late Middle Ages, there's a tremendous amount of theological but also legal writing around tears, which were thought almost, they were described as a gift, the gift of tears, the gift coming from God. There was almost a sense in which tears were not a biological phenomenon. They were
a spiritual phenomenon
manifesting physically. And so as Mary's described, weeping, exposing her body in this very dramatic gesture, the audience understands this as an offer of proof, but of her sincerity, right? Sort of the authenticness of her claim. Before that, she'd just been citing legal texts the way the devil had. But that's the pivot. The case isn't over immediately, but it's largely over at that point. And soon the text ends with the chorus of angels singing Ave Maria, and the demon who had been representing hell in this is sort of sent back to hell, gnashing his teeth.
The prosecutor rarely gets that kind of treatment at the end of a case. So what kind of cases, other kind of cases, would we find involving the devil and Mary? And is it oversimplifying to say that Satan is representing the letter of the law and marry the spirit of the law?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I don't think that's oversimplifying. I think that's definitely at stake. Although when we talk today about the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, we're sometimes, I think, in contemporary jurisprudence, we're setting up this tension between law and justice, recognizing
yes.
that they can lead to different results. In the Middle Ages, the assertion that an unjust law simply wasn't law was one that could be made a little bit easier. And the conversations around strict legality on the one hand versus justice on the other, I think took place in a much richer, frankly, intellectual place. But there are some very important points where the devil in this text is made to represent a very interesting kind of understanding of law. He says at one point in the text, Christ says to him as judge at one point in the text, I have founded the laws and I give authority to the laws. The laws do not give authority to me. So this coming from the figure of Christ and judge, this would have caused some gasps among medieval jurists reading this, because the assertion that the law could be an expression of sovereign will was not universally accepted. The principle that a king may actually himself be under law was a very widely accepted principle, and there's lots of counterexamples.
You mean subject to the law?
Subject to mm-hmm. law, yes, in no way above it. So I think this text is partly playing with a very live political issue about precisely is the king bound by the law? And there's a lot of texts, both theologically and jurisprudentially in the Middle Ages, that say, of course. And there's also some arguments made by some very prominent figures in the late Middle Ages that sovereigns, whether kings or popes, are actually not bound by law. It was a live issue. And I think, you know, our listeners might recognize that this question of whether who exercise political power are in fact bound by the laws that bind the rest of us, this remains a central question for our democracy.
What kind of writings are these that we're talking about describing these litigations between Mary and the devil and sometimes involving Jesus?
Yeah. So the genre of these texts, there are about 45 extant versions of the manuscript survive for us. And for medieval texts, that's quite a large number. These circulated a lot. They were very popular. They were sort of the equivalent of a bestseller. And one of the reasons they were a bestseller is because they were used quite actively in the law schools, where students were learning legal procedure. There's a very vibrant intellectual community in the late Middle Ages of universities. Law schools are emerging there. And this text was used widely to teach law students how to think about legal procedure, how to think about advocacy. We know this because some of the manuscripts have their notes and they would be required to supply the legal authorities for different things that happen in the case. So that is a real pedagogical angle, and we know this. We see law professors sending copies of it to each other as gifts. You know, but there's another version of the text that's stripped of all the technical citations to legal documents, but maintains the same trial, the same action. And these are usually included in devotional texts and are part of this is sort of a high watermark for Marian devotion within medieval Christianity. And these texts are really, really meant to emphasize Mary's role in the redemption, in the atonement of mankind. And these texts also circulate sometimes as gifts, and they'll have little headings that say, this is why we call Mary our mediatrix or our advocata, which is a feminization of these Latin terms, which are typically masculine. It plays a really interesting role, I think, intellectually and culturally in the late Middle Ages.
But she's going to win every case, right?
She does. She does win, of course. And these texts that I'm describing aren't the only ones that imagine Mary defeating Satan or a demon in contestations for human souls. There's older traditions within Christianity. And then there are subsequent ones, right? Shortly after these texts sort of have their day in the sun, we get the emergence of the Faust tradition in Europe as well. What's interesting about those is in the Faust tradition, the devil sometimes wins. In some of the earliest versions of the Faust story,
well, he beats Faust.
Yes, but in the later versions, right? Faust is redeemed by the
love of
the love and the tears of the scorned woman. But in the earlier ones, he loses and is taken to hell.
And the devil then represents, I mean, if he's representing the law as written.
Yes. Yeah, to return to your really good question earlier, which I think I veered away from, I do think there is a real sense in which these texts are presenting the devil as the one who understands law in its strict applications without any room for mercy or without any flexibility or sensibility to context. There's a quote from a 20th century law professor who taught contracts at Harvard for a long time, Grant Gilmore, which some of your listeners may know, particularly if the lawyers out there. He says, nowhere will due process be more assiduously followed than in hell. So he's essentially presenting hell as this incredibly rule-bound place. Right? So, yeah, I think the devil's jurisprudence is really a rule-bound jurisprudence. And what these texts are trying to do in part is to show what the possibilities of justice are, and that how much they require thinking larger than simply a rigid application of rules. What's interesting, I think, for Christianity is that there's this tension that's at the heart of it, which is that the salvation of humankind, according to Christianity, is an act of grace. And we typically think of grace as in tension somehow with justice, right? Grace is a suspension, perhaps, of justice. And one of the things my work both on Sanctuary but also on the Devil's Lawsuit, I think, is trying to figure out is this aspect of medieval jurisprudence in which justice and grace were not understood as in opposition to one another, but were actually understood as complementary, as bound up in an understanding of law that could accommodate both, and that's where a lot of my research and my intellectual work is directed.
Sounds like where probation would come in.
potentially, yeah, very very modern legal practice. In my opinion, although it's outside the scope of our conversation, some much needed reforms could be implemented. But we can leave that for another day.
this is a problem that comes up occasionally today, or a question. I'm not sure if it would have been true in the Middle Ages when things seemed to move much more slowly, but this whole sense of, well, when this law was enacted, it meant something different than it would mean today. I'm thinking, for example, of an originalist constitutional approach versus a different kind of approach that we would see today.
Yeah. Medieval jurists, the men that I studied, were incredibly attentive to language and spent a lot of time thinking about what words meant. And they had to, because they had inherited this large textual legal tradition from the ancient Roman Empire, in which there were many words that either were nonsensical in the Middle Ages or had entirely different meanings in the Middle Ages, and they were deeply attuned to the necessity of understanding the meaning of words. Now, they often got it quite wrong, and they were often inventive in the way they thought about this, but they did understand that language is malleable, that language has a history, that words change, context change over time. This is something they were attentive to. The notion that we sometimes hear, I think, from certain schools of legal thought today, that there's a single true meaning to a text that can be discerned and is binding on subsequent generations, that would have struck medieval jurists as quite an odd way of thinking about it. It would have struck the founding generation as quite an odd way of thinking about things as well. But we can perhaps leave that aside. But since I mentioned the sort of inventiveness around language, I'll mention one example that I really like because it's relevant to our conversation about the devil. The word devil, diabolos, through the Greek, typically means something like an accuser, and I think it's fairly direct translation of the Hebrew Satan or Shatan.
Yeah, I mean the advocate you see sometimes.
Yes, the advocate, the adversary, the accuser. And the Greek word carries this sense of one who casts an accusation, right? medieval jurists were kind of creative when they were trying to reconstruct the meaning of words through etymology. And one of the writers I came across says, well, he's called the diabolus because it's two words, dia and bolus, but he doesn't understand them in their actual original meaning. He says dia means two and bolus means a morsel, which is correct. It is a word for a small bite. He says because the devil seeks to separate the body from the soul and eat them both, devour them both. So it's sort of beautiful in its creativity. It's completely untethered from the actual meaning of the Greek word. But this is quite common. You can see the jurists in the Middle Ages doing these kinds of things with words, sometimes quite creatively.
Well, we still see a lot of contortions when it comes to interpreting laws and theology, don't we?
Sadly, yes.
We'll look further at the role of the devil at law in the Middle Ages and how it applies today, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Carl Shoemaker. We're looking at the role of the devil at law in the Middle Ages and how it applies still today in some ways, surprising ways. And we've talked about these litigations that were legal textbooks, let's say, kind of mock trials involving Mary pleading for what I've generally called the spirit of the law and the devil pleading the side of a literal interpretation of the law and, of course, some poor defendant in between. But the judge in this whole configuration seems to have varied. Sometimes it's Jesus. Sometimes it's developed in another way.
Yeah, so in the Satan trials, that's right. The figure of the judge is sort of in the text that I'm particularly studying. Sometimes referred to as in the one person of the Godhead as the Father, but sometimes it's Christ, and the text sort of moves back and forth, which I think is sort of an expression of Trinitarian theology. But what's interesting about these is that the judge is in these cases occupies the place. It's very much the place the judge occupies in this Roman law tradition that emerges out of the late Middle Ages. That is, there's no jury the way we would have in England. The judge has control over what evidence is brought, what witnesses, what testimony is there. And this is quite representative of the direction that legal practice takes in Europe after in continental Europe after the abolition of the ordeal. In England, of course, after 1215, there's a different direction, and there's a reliance on juries, right? A body of men in those days, all men called from the vicinity who were required to pass judgment on their neighbors. It settles at 12. In the early days of this practice, the number could vary. It could be 36. It could be, we have records from the 13th century, as many as 84 men showing up. And it differed from contemporary practice in another way. They were expected to bring with them some knowledge of the underlying events that they would be judging. Of course, today, and if anyone has ever been called for jury duty, you know that having knowledge of the events is grounds for exclusion from the jury. But the idea that a body of lay people without any specific legal training using their conscience and their common sense ought to be able to judge their neighbors is a very old idea within the common law. And it emerges precisely at this moment in the 13th century.
And how does the role of the judge change then?
The judge today in the American common law system is often understood as particularly trial judges as occupying a fairly passive role. The parties have mostly the discretion to determine what kind of evidence they're going to bring, what kind of stipulations they'll agree to, the course of the trial. And we often imagine the judge, at least in the contemporary common law tradition, as a sort of umpire who sits passively letting the sides battle it out in this adversarial contest. That wasn't actually true of the English common law in the Middle Ages. The judges, we know from the records, are taking a much more active role directing, sometimes even directing the outcome of cases. But over time, in the intervening centuries, this idea of the passive judge sitting sort of quietly as an arbiter but not taking an active role in shaping the litigation, that tradition has sort of developed, and it's quite distinct from the model in place in many parts of Europe in which the judge is the most most active player in determining how the case will be brought, how it will be presented, what evidence he or she wants to hear, and so on. So that difference is quite stark between the common law tradition and what happens in the continent.
In the Middle Ages, you still have, though, in addition to a judge and a jury in some form, you have, in effect, a defense attorney and a prosecutor?
Not until much later, actually. It's quite striking within the common law tradition how late it takes for the role of the public prosecutor to arise. It's really a 19th century emergence, which is quite striking. In the centuries before that, you may, as the victim of a crime, have been required to pay your own lawyer to prosecute the crime in many cases. So we might find that quite shocking.
Yeah.
Actually, the American colonies and then after the War of Independence, the states were early adopters of figures who played this role of a public prosecutor, much earlier actually than in England. And one argument that may be right, I think, is that the experience of New York colonists, their experience with Dutch legal practice actually led them to see the importance of having public prosecutors. So, but it's a really late, it emerges really late. And defense attorneys as well in the criminal setting. Attorneys are present in medieval legal practice around lots and lots of issues around inheritance and land and disputes. But in the criminal trials, attorneys show up a little bit later.
And if we go back to these legal exercises, these mock trials involving Mary and Satan and a judge in some form, how does the sentencing come out? Is that even a part of those trials?
Yeah, so in these the only criminal aspect of these trials is a portion within them in which Satan directs his advocate, the demon who's representing him in the court of heaven. Sort of, it's a really interesting progression. It begins the demon initially says, look, we owned all these souls and they were taken from us unjustly. And he's referencing here the descensus Christi or the harrowing of hell, the tradition that Christ went down and liberated the captives from hell after his crucifixion but before his resurrection. The demon says, we had peaceful possession of these. In a really colorful language, says we had peaceful possession of them where we were torturing them for thousands of years. So, and we want them back. So it's a kind of case of unjust spoliation. That doesn't work. Mary, through quite effective advocacy, points out that the Roman law requires that you have clean hands in the acquisition of these. And since the way in which humans came to hell in the first place was through Satan's fraudulence in the garden, they can't make this claim of adverse possession.
Kind of like entrapment.
Yeah, something like that. So they're fraudulent in getting possession of these goods. They can't claim the protection of the law now. That's basic. And she quite effectively cites expertly the aspects of Roman law which stand for these propositions. So the demon switches tactics and says, okay, well, there was a sin in the garden committed by Adam and Eve. It's a crime against an infinite being in God, and therefore the punishment has to be infinite. So there can be no atonement. There can be no forgiveness. This tract actually is the direction that causes Mary in the end to abandon the technical legal argument and to do this very dramatic gesture with her the display of her body. So that's the only point at which sentencing was about to happen, and that would have been of humankind, right? But Mary is successful. So all the demon gets is sent home humiliated and empty-handed. But of course, he's still under a sentence that was imposed upon all of the demons who fell, which is this eternal eternity in hell. Although, I should hasten to point out, there were prominent theologians in the Middle Ages who did not think that hell was an eternal place. There were prominent theologians all the way through the 13th century who imagined that God must also reconcile Satan and the demons into himself, that there can't be this eternal separation. That view that view doesn't take, and by the 13th century, the Orthodox views are very clear that hell is an eternal place. But in the Middle Ages, there were those who couldn't imagine that it must be so, and imagine that there might be some eventual reconciliation.
That That might somewhat mitigate any fear of divine retribution, though, for crimes committed in life.
Maybe that's why the church wasn't keen to follow that view of hell being perhaps not eternal. But the orthodoxy is today that it's quite eternal.
As we get later into legal history in England in particular, this role of the judge as a sentencer, though, how does that develop?
Yeah, so it was fairly straightforward in the late medieval period. If you were convicted of a felony, whether it was theft or murder or arranged, there was sort of eight traditional categories of felony behavior. The sentence was the same every time. You were to be executed, typically by hanging. The judge having to sentence in the way we think about it today is really the product of the emergence of the prison as a site for punishment. Now, there were prisons in the Middle Ages. They were used to hold people until their trial or to hold them until it was determined what to be done with them. But the medieval period didn't really see prisons used that often as a site of punishment. It was rather the pretrial holding place. That's right. The penitentiary as we know it, or the prison as we know it, it's really a modern phenomenon. They emerge as a site of punishment really in the early 19th century, in the early 1800s. And the U.S., the United States, is actually sort of the place where some of the earliest experiments with the prison emerge. And these are wildly popular. Visiting dignitaries from Europe come. They want to tour these prisons. They want to see them. There's questions about can we reproduce the prison in Europe? And its promise as a site of the reformation of souls is really, really quite pronounced. Now, within a few short years in the 19th century, this project is pronounced a failure. And there's a lot of hand-wringing about how we can get prisons to realize their promise. And in fact, for the next 200 years, there's this cycle of leaning into prisons as a site of punishment, our inability to conceive of any other way to do it, and at the same time throwing up our hands that the prison is never achieving any of the policy goals that we've attached to it, whether it's deterrence or rehabilitation or any other range of sort of approaches to punishment. So the judge as a sentencer is really a product of that legal development. Before that, it was, you know, there wasn't a lot of options. There was execution, perhaps exile, transportation to Australia or to the penal colonies like Georgia in the New World. But prior to that, it was really just an execution or acquittal was really, really the outcome.
Well, I guess that's progress. But it certainly gives us a very fresh and interesting look at not just the devil at law in the Middle Ages, but the whole development of the legal system in Europe and in England and, as it turns out, too, in the United States. And thanks very much, Carl Shoemaker, for enlightening us about some of these rather strange to us practices.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.